Okay. So, Divine Fantasies. All right. So the starting point here is an idea that I came up with, a reading I came up with several years ago, which is relevant to all sorts of methodological issues in terms of biblical interpretation. It's not, I imagine, a surprise to any of you that there is more than one story of creation in Genesis. Probably all of you are aware that there are two. In fact, as we'll see in a moment, there are at least three. But we'll start with two, because that's usually the number people work with. And it's probably also not a surprise to you that the names of God in the two stories, which we can tentatively identify as Genesis 1 through the beginning of 2, and then Genesis 2 and 3, that the names of God are different in the two stories. Right? That in the first story, the story of the 7 days of creation, the name of God used is Elohim. In the second story, the name of God used is Hashem Elohim, right? Yud Kei Vav Kei Elohim. Okay, right? That's a given, and that anyone who knows higher biblical criticism knows that this is the starting point for the whole deconstruction of the Pentateuch. What I noticed a couple of years ago is that obviously these questions are not new, but that there was a fascinating response to it in Rashi, the classic medieval commentator, which I think probably has not been developed as fully as it might. Rashi, in his commentary on the very first verse of Genesis, says, and you know, he just says it on the word Bereshit, Bara Elokim, and it's, you know, it looks innocent until you figure out what he's doing. He says that it arose in God's mind to create the world with justice. But God saw that a world created entirely with justice could not survive, and therefore he partnered mercy with justice to create the world. Okay. You look at it on the surface, that looks like, you know, rabbinic imagination about the divine, right, about the nature of the divinity, right? It doesn't look like it's anchored in the text at all. What it is, however, is a solution to the divine name problem in the creation stories. Because the name Elohim, right, stands for justice. The name Hashem, Yudke Vavke, stands for mercy. And so what Rashi is doing textually is saying that original, right, that the first story of creation, right, which uses only the name Elohim, is the way God intended to create the world, only with justice. The second creation story, right, Hashem Elohim, right, which uses both names, mercy and justice, is the way God actually created the world. Okay, and a solution both to the divine name problem and to the apparent contradictions in the narrative of the two stories are that the first one is, right, the first story of creation, the 7 days of creation, right, is not intended as fact, right? So the first, when I first gave this as a public Dvar Torah, right, it was called Divine Fiction. I had an interesting conversation with Ezra Karger. Some of you know, is the David Karger's 13-year-old son. So we were having a conversation about literature and Bible and stuff like that. So I asked him, of course I primed the pump, what genre is the first chapter of Genesis? If you were reading it, right, as literature. And he got immediately that the genre is fantasy. Right? Now I want to talk about what the difference is between fantasy and allegory. Right? Because it's a very important difference between allegory, which people know you can read Genesis as, and fantasy is a different genre. Allegory is an attempt to create a world that has direct, right, an imaginary world that has direct correspondence with our world. Okay, it's a representation of the world we have. Fantasy is the creation of an alternate world. It's not supposed to correspond to the world. Right? It's a different world, generally one which is created by changing certain things in our world and seeing how those implications would play out all the way. Right? And Genesis 1 has all the hallmarks. Worlds like that, right, tend to be very, very, right, very, very clear and orderly, right? Because they're abstractions, right? They're abstractions. They're imagined versions of a world, as opposed to the reality, which tends not to, right, to make conceptual schemes so neatly. So Ezra got immediately, right? The Genesis one is, right, in the genre of fantasy, right? And so that's stage one, is to understand that you have, if I'm correct in the way I'm reading Rashi, I'm really, really confident that what Rashi is doing is solving the divine name problem. I think it's at least plausible that he's not only solving the divine name problem, but also the contradictions in narrative. And solving them, I think, in a very intriguing way, right? By saying that, right, one has to regard the vision of an orderly universe that exists in chapter one as, right, as God's imagination of what a world could be like that was created purely with justice. As part of the background for this, one should know also that in rabbinic theology, although this is a very problematic concept philosophically, but in rabbinic theology, I imagine this is a common medieval notion, justice and nature are equated. We tend to have, and particularly in the aftermath of all the natural disasters around us, we tend to think that nature and justice are certainly not connected, maybe even opposed. But in rabbinic theology, the name Elohim stands both for the God who is in nature and the God, right, and the God who is just. So one understands why one would have a vision of a world, right, which is, right, in which they're really it's really a very orderly natural world. It doesn't mention issues like free will, which is what messes up, right? Which is what messes up all orderly natural systems. The way chapter two, right? In chapter two, the world gets messed up by free will. Okay. Now that, well, in and of itself, I think is a fascinating notion. Like, why would and there is. And I think that there's room for tremendous thought to try and think about what it means for the rabbis to conceive of parts of Torah. And Rashi didn't make this up, right? Rashi's interpretation is drawn from the Midrash. What it means, you know, to have God writing alternate, writing fantasy fiction. But I want to take it for starters now, right, just to legitimate the notion, right, that one way that the rabbis deal with with biblical narrative, is to see part of it as God's imagination. Okay, now, from a rigorous philosophic perspective, the notion that God has an imagination is controversial. Right, I think that Maimonides, for one, would be horrified at the notion that God has an imagination. So what I'm going to do is play a sort of unfair intellectual game. I'm going to take one part of Maimonides. And use it to talk about something else, which Maimonides has noted, divine imagination, Maimonides would have hated. Maimonides' conception of God in that sense may or may not have had deep resonance in Jewish history. There's another conception of God that Maimonides has, which has had tremendous impact, which is the notion of God as simple and indivisible. That, right, part of the definition of God is that there aren't, right, God does not have parts, and God, right, God cannot be divided. And that's something that particularly, perhaps as a reaction to Christianity, has had tremendous traction in Jewish history. So I want to think about, what does it mean for God to create gender? If one conceives of part of the basic definition of God as being indivisible. And particularly, what would it mean for God to create a being which at least some readings of Torah say are created in his image, and then introduce the notion of gender into that being which is in his image if God is indivisible. So one could take the position, right, and I offer this as a starting point, that the only way in which God could create gender is if God had an imagination. Right? Because if indivisibility is a central part of, right, what it means to be God, so the creating gender means that God has to be able to imagine something that is entirely unlike himself.
Getting close to
him. Okay. I'll be wary of that. Hopefully more comprehensible. Okay. So in order to spell out that idea, we also have to talk about not in depth, because we're not doing a session on biblical interpretation, but just to have a background as to how the biblical stories of creation treat gender. Okay, and I want to put in as a methodological introduction that there are two, I think, serious misunderstandings of the mode of rabbinic interpretation known as midrash. One mode is to claim that midrash is not actually exegesis; it doesn't take things out of the text, it's eisegesis, it puts things into the text, and is not intended as a serious reading. While there are cases of Midrash which are that, And there are specific terms in the tradition for midrash which is not explicit, which is not intended as interpretation. My own position is that the vast majority of rabbinic midrash is intended as interpretation. Okay, that's A. Secondly, however, even the people who believe that midrash is exegesis often then take it as a claim that it's exegesis built on specific anomalies in the text. Right? That there are details of the text which are anomalous, and the rabbis use those, right, to claim that the text has more meaning than would be read in ordinary fashion. And therefore, the way in which one judges a rabbinic reading is by the strength of the particular textual anomaly that the midrash is built on. My own sense is that this is actually not the correct way to read midrash. And I'm going to just give a five-sentence overview of what I think midrash is, and we can, at least in some cases, and we can explore that in some other forum at some point. I start with an insight. I think it's James Barr had many years ago, or JBL, I think. He wrote an essay in which he pointed out that if we had to ask ourselves what literary interpretation is literary interpretation midrash or pshat in the standard sense? The answer is that literary interpretation, right, the way in which we read stories generally, is parallel to midrash. What it involves is doing things like examining the motivations of characters when their motivations are not stated explicitly in the text. Right? What literary interpretation on the whole is trying to provide information that the text does not provide at least explicitly. Okay.
What do you mean by
shot? Shot is, you know, straightforward reading. We just say what's in the words. Right? Literary interpretation says, look, reading the words doesn't get you enough. Let's try and figure out what we can do that goes beyond what the text says explicitly, and yet claim that's what the text intended to say. Now, if you're reading that way, right, you're reading, right, in which you want to say, want to deal with motivations of characters that are not spelled out explicitly, right, what's the prehistory of this character, right, before we meet them, right, what experiences must they have gone through, issues like that. So we can frame that in two ways. We can write very long essays in which we provide all the evidence for our interpretation, or we can try and make the story larger in the way that we think it should have been. Right? So we can write a long essay explaining that, let's say, the reason that God spoke to Abraham, right, is because Abraham must have had philosophic training. Right, there must have been, because it's clear from the story that Abraham must have been more receptive to God than other beings. What could have made Abraham more receptive? Right, we can then say, well, it seems to us likely that reason. Right, I can write a whole essay, right, in which I try to demonstrate from various places that Abraham thought philosophically. Right, and that must be why he was open to God's interpretation. Or I can write a very brief vignette in which Abraham discovers the cosmological argument. Right, in which he says, gee, you know, everything that happens has a cause, that goes back infinitely. There must have been a cause. Now if I write that, it doesn't mean that I'm making a historical claim that the way in which Abraham came to God was because at one moment when he was 17, right, he happened, a particular episode happened to him which made him realize the first cause. What I'm saying is that in order for the narrative to make sense, there must have been, right, some kind of prior grounding, right, some experience in Abraham's life which made him receptive to divine command. Right, so what Midrash does is it takes that whole essay and it concretizes the interpretation, right, in a particular expansion of the narrative. Right, as some of my students pointed out, the best mashal for this, and nowadays is something that may not be familiar to all of you, it's called fan fiction. Right, many television shows, right, millions of people throughout the world want to figure out what are these characters really doing, right? So what they do, instead of writing long scholarly essays, they write short stories, right, involving the same characters in times other than the character which they appear in the show. Some of these become so entrenched that everyone then sees them as part of the story. For my own self, I'm a Trekkie, right? I watched the original Star Trek. And there have been several hundred books written, you know, official books written, most of which are just bad midrash. But there was one book, which is a series of stories about the adventures of the crew of the Starship Enterprise when they were still in school, which was so resonating with everybody that many, many books later, right, include that as if it were part of the original series. Right? They all quote that because it was just so true to everyone's understanding of the characters. It explained so much about who they were that it just became part of the story. Right? So certain midrashim, right, and Rashi has a tremendous ear for those kinds of midrashim, are so true to the text that you just can't imagine the text without them anymore. Okay, but when you're writing midrash, you don't cite all the evidence, right? The convention of the genre is you find one minor textual hook which you attach this narrative expansion to, but it doesn't tell you that's why you said it. You said it because you read the whole story. Okay, so I want to put that in. So what Rashi does here, right, is not based on because it says Elokim Hashem. It's a reading of the whole story. This makes sense. Okay, so with that introduction, let's take a look at if we want to understand rabbinic conceptions of gender, right, we have to try and understand. We have to have a vision of what the whole treatment of gender in Genesis is, right, and then evaluate rabbinic interpretations not just because of the specific textual problems they cite, but because of the because of seeing it as a reading of the whole story, in which they are citing a piece of evidence which may be important, but it's certainly not the whole story. Okay, so what do we know about gender in the text of Genesis? The first thing that we can say is that in the three creation stories, the only being which is gendered are human beings. And although we all conceive of the animals as gendered, and they're even told to be fruitful and multiply, the terms for gender are never mentioned, right, in the creation stories about any being other than human beings. Okay, well, the reason we think of all the animals that way is because afterwards, in the flood story, all the animals are gendered. But in the creation story, gender is reserved for human beings. Okay. Second point is that not only is gender reserved for human beings, but the text goes out of its way to use basically every way of gendering human beings it can. So in the first creation stories, human beings are described as zachar u'nekeva, right, which we would describe as a description on the basis of physiology, right, male and female. Okay, in the second story, right, we have descriptions by personality, Adam and Chava, as parents, right, av ve'em, as relational, as ish ve'isha. Okay, right, so you have four different ways of gendering human beings in these stories.
Can you get male and female?
When is Adam called
father? After he names Chava, he says, therefore shall a man leave his mother and his father. Okay? Mm-hmm. Right? So you have male and female, ish and isha, which we might describe as husband and wife, av and aim, which is mother and father, and Adam and Chava, personal names. We don't have brother and sister. But it's striking when you realize that there are no other gendered beings, but human beings are gendered over and over again, right, in every different way. Right, that's another background for rabbinic readings. Okay, that's a second issue. Right, so one issue is just establishing this notion of divine imagination. Second is establishing that the gendering of human beings is a central concern of the text of Genesis. All right, issue number three. Granted that human beings become gendered, right, and this is the issue that we're really going to focus on in rabbinic text this week and probably over the next several weeks, how were human beings created, right, how were human beings engendered? I will say, right, if we can... So the straightforward thing that most people are aware of is that in the first and third creation stories, there is no evidence that men and women are created at different times, right? But in the second story, right, Adam is created first, and Chava is created out of a piece of Adam. Whatever piece that is, we'll see, is something that occupies the rabbis tremendously. What I want to point out is the way in which the biblical text uses number in ways that I think, when you look at it, will be striking enough that you'll see that this can't possibly be accidental, and I hope you'll also see that it can't possibly be the result of composite sources either. It would just be a tremendously reductive way of reading it. To do this, to some degree, you'll have to look at the Hebrew to get this, although the translation I do the best I can. I want to start with a text that is, it's somewhat tangential, though not entirely, but I want to present to you a mode of reading Bible that may not be obvious, and hopefully after this it'll become a little bit more clear. If you look at the text in Genesis 9:6, okay, this is not often seen as a creation narrative. This is on the first page, it's the fourth text. Right, Genesis 9, it actually occurs after the flood, but it recapitulates the creation of human beings. All right, the verse is, Shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishofech, ki b'telem elokim asa et ha'adam. If you read it that way, right, usually the way it would be recited if we were having a public recitation, we would say it again this way. Shofech dam ha'adam, which means the shedder of the blood of the human being, ba'adam damo yishofech, shall have his blood shed by a human being. Ki b'tzelem elokim asa et ha'adam, because the human being was created in the image of God, or in the mold of Elohim. If you're reading it, right, and if you're translating, that's a sensible way of reading it. If you're listening to it in Hebrew, you'll see that it doesn't work poetically, because the line lengths are wrong. Right? If you listen to it again, you'll see that it shouldn't be broken into three; it should be broken into four. Right, Shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech, ki b'tzelem elokim asa et ha'adam. Right, you hear the syllable breaks, you understand that that's the way it should be read poetically. Now, when we understand that it's supposed to be four lines and not three, so then we'll notice that in lines 1, 2, and 4, the noun is adam. Right, whereas in line 3, the noun is elokim. Okay, now what's the purpose of this structure? Okay, we have a four line poem, right? In which we stressed the name Adam, even though we could have used pronouns, in three of them, and in the fourth one, right? In the fourth one, Adam is replaced by Elohim. Okay, so we know to some degree this is telling us that Adam is in some way created in the mold of God, but actually what it does is create a critical structural ambiguity, and I'm going to set that up as follows. Probably many of you have seen and been impressed, as I was, by the bumper sticker which says, "Why do we kill people who kill people to show people that killing right to show people that killing people is wrong?" I always thought that was a great bumper sticker, and it always bothered me reading this verse. Right, you know, when the verse says, "Right, because you kill the human being in the image of God, so therefore we're going to kill you." Duh. Right, the person you're killing is also in the image of God. Right, what's going on here? Okay, so the answer is that poetically, there are two ways in which you can read this poem structurally. You can read it the way most translators have it, which is chiastic, A-B-B-A, right? Meaning that when we say that human beings are created in the mold of Elohim, that's an explanation for, right, that puts the human being who was killed, right, you read A-B-A-B, right? Sorry, you read A-B-A-B, right? So the first line talks about the human being there is the victim, right? The shedder of the blood of the human being, okay? And so we say line 3, right, is kibitzelam elokim, right? We're saying is that because the human being whose blood was shed is in the image of God, therefore he shall be killed. But you could also read it chiastically, which is to say that if the shedder of the blood of the human being shall have his blood shed by a human being, right? That's the point of line two is not to emphasize that you die. The point is to emphasize the obligation for human beings to establish justice. Now, why are human beings obligated to establish justice? Because Elohim is the word for justice, right? So, what gives human beings both the obligation and the right to establish retribution for murder, even though ordinarily they would have no right because the murderer too is in the image of God, is that human beings are obligated to be in the image of the just God. And so the poem is set up, right, so that the Elohim replaces both the Adam who is killed and the Adam who executes in retribution. Okay, I want to set that up as, right, I think that if you look at it structurally, it's pretty clear that that's what it's supposed to accomplish. And set it up to introduce you to the notion that the way in which biblical poetry is structured, what it will do, at least on occasion, is set up a repetitive structure and change one element to make a point. Okay, now with that in mind, Now let's look at number. Okay, and I want to look at let's take a look at number in Genesis 1. Okay, so in Genesis 1, right, it says, Elohim created the human being, right, literally the Adam, in his mold. Right, in the mold of Elohim, he created it or him, right, the pronoun could be personal or, right, or not. Male and female, he created them. Okay, now that's obviously a problem. Right, is it singular or is it plural? Right? Right, so one could, if one chose, say that obviously what you have here is somebody glossing in, right, and putting in male and female, he created them, being a little bit sloppy and using, right, because right, they had to put in gender because some of that was missing from the first version of the story, right, and they decided that they could deal with an agreement, right, with an agreement like, with a pronoun lack of parallelism. Okay, could be. Or we could just claim that biblical style is not doesn't care so much about number. We all understand that in terms of, right, in terms of deep structure, the grammatical meaning of a collective noun is no different than, right, than a plural, right? And so he created him means he created him representing the entirety of the human species, and there's no substantive difference between saying he created him and he created them. Okay. Yeah.
Elohim is already plural, isn't it?
God is plural. Yes, Elohim is plural, but the Adam is not.
Right, but maybe that.
But maybe that also gives sanction. We're already playing with singular and plural anyway, right? Because Elohim appears to be a plural. Okay. I want to take a look at the way Genesis 5 tells this, right, tells the same story. Okay? So, right, you see, this is the book of the Toldot, generations, consequences, whatever you want to say, however you want to translate Toldot. On the day Elohim created Adam, an image of Elohim he made him, male and female he created them. He blessed them, he called their name Adam, on the day of their creation. All right, so now we at least notice, you know, it happens twice. Now that might just mean that this is, you know, that we're being hypersensitive, and so, right, and so when it says him instead of them, really the narrator of the Bible doesn't care. Number doesn't matter.
Well, it could be this.
Right, that's what I said. Right, grammatically, it's the same.
Except it refers to Adam explicitly as plural.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that in one moment. Okay. I want to point out two things. One, I guess Deborah already pointed out, is that at the end. Right, it actually brings it together because it says he called their name Adam, right? So it specifically puts a singular, the being who we thought until now was singular, right? Right, is described as he called their name, right? He called their name, not their names, right? So it sounds a little bit more serious. But now I just want to recite it to you in Hebrew, okay? And just listen to the sound of it, particularly paying attention to the ends of lines, okay? Zeh sefer toldot Adam, v'yom bro Elohim Adam, בדמות אלוקים עשה אותו. זכר נקבה ברעם, ויברך אותם, ויקרא את שמם אדם, ויום היא ברעם. Okay? Right, if you're sensitive to sound, so what you have is a poem, right, which rhymes, except for one line, which is put in the singular specifically to point out that it doesn't fit. Okay, right, because obviously the author, you can't talk about it as sloppiness, right? You have people who are capable of, you know, of writing, and v'hi bar'am also, as the rabbis note, is a very peculiar way to write the line. It's designed to emphasize the meter and the rhyme, right? So you see that everything is supposed to rhyme, and that line just doesn't. It's supposed to stick out like the William James Building or whatever. right, this peculiar, utterly anomalous thing in the middle. Right in the middle of the harmonious, whatever harmonious environment. Okay, so as background then to figuring out how the rabbis are going to read Genesis, what we have is a conception that the Torah can describe not only what happened, but what God thought about doing. We have a text that really focuses on the genderedness of human beings. I have a text that calls your attention to the right to an ambivalence about whether human beings were created single or plural. Okay, all that is what the rabbis bring to the table, right? When they try and interpret this. Okay, so now let's take a look at the first rabbinic text, which is all that we have any ambition of doing today, that we're trying to accomplish. Right, this is the Talmud on Ketubot 7b, right? Ketubot is the tractate of the Mishnah and Talmud that deals with marriage contracts, among other things, so it's not a totally inappropriate place to find discussion of gender. We have to share.
Wait, if she had the booklet already,
it's the second page. It's just the reverse side of the booklet if you have it. Okay. So we begin with a Braita, which is a text from the period of the Mishnah that did not make it into the canonical compilation, but which, for the purposes of the Talmud, is roughly indistinguishable in authority from the text of the Mishnah, which says, we say what's called the blessing of grooms, Birkat Chatanim, although generally we treat this legally as the blessing of couples, and it refers to couples, but halachically, for whatever reason, it is referred to as the blessing of grooms. In the presence of a minyan, all 7 days, beginning with the date of the wedding. All right, this is what we call nowadays Sheva Brachot. Right, it's the parties we make for bride and groom in order to bless them after the wedding. Okay, Rav Yehuda puts in a line which may or may not be significant for us. He says that you only say the blessing all 7 days if you have somebody new there each time. Right, so when you're setting up the Sheva Brachot for a bride and groom, you always have to make sure that one person was invited who wasn't there for any of the previous ones. Okay, that's tangential for us. What blessing does one say? Okay, so Rav Yehuda now, it's one of the Amoraim, gives us a list of 6 blessings. Right, we call it 7 because we make many significant rituals are said, as my wife says, in the presence of a great beverage. So the first blessing is who creates the fruit of the vine. Okay, and then there are 6 others. If you look at the text of the 6 others, so you'll notice that numbers 2 and 3 seem to have a certain similarity. Right? In fact,
where's the one about the fruit of the vine?
That's not there. That's just an assumption. The reason we talk about 7 is because we add the blessing of the fruit of the vine. Right? But they only have 6.
You left out 4, 5, and 6.
Too. I left out 4, 5, and 6, which deal with the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the happiness of the couple, and we're not interested in that.
They're distilling the text.
Yes. This is a distillation of the text. So number 1 is God is to bless God who created all for His glory. The second is to bless God who is the former of the human being. And in Hebrew, there are different verbs for to create and to form. And we'll talk about that significant because the verb to create occurs in the first and third creation stories, and the verb to form occurs in the second one. So one of the ways in which you can tell how they're reading the story is by figuring out which verbs they use. Right, so the text of the blessings uses to form, which means it's grounded, at least partially in the story of in the second creation story, where human beings are not created out of nothing, right? They're formed out of the dust of the earth. Okay, so the second blessing is, blessing of God, the former of the human being. The third blessing is, who formed the human being in His mold, the mold and image of His construction, and established for Him from it an eternal construction. Blessed are you, Hashem, former of the human being. So it's just like the second one. It has a long introduction. So prima facie we have an issue. What's the point of blessing number 2 if all it is an excerpt from blessing number 3? Okay? That's the basic framework we need to emerge from here. We should point out, however, that the third blessing, which is the full one, clearly reads the 2 creation stories as one, or at least as compatible, because the notion of human beings being created in the mold of God occurs only in Genesis 1. The notion of human beings being created in the image of God, and I'm translating differently than most people do. Usually people translate Tselem as Elohim, and Dmut as likeness or something like that, which...
Tselem as what?
People usually try, when people say human beings are created in the image of God, they're translating the biblical phrase Tselem Elohim. But it's not clear what Tselem has to do with image. The word Tselem is a Hebrew word, in fact, only occurs one other time in the Bible, outside of the creation of human beings. And that's also talking about the nature of human beings. There is no such thing as a Tselem in Hebrew, at least a cursory check in the Bible, other than human beings, although it exists in Aramaic, in Daniel, where they bow down, right? So in rabbinic literature, a tselem becomes an idol, right? And that actually is significant, I think, for a different notion which I'll mention shorthand. An idea that I have, which will probably come up again, I gave it to Bartura and Shul once, called "Can God Commit Idolatry?" Can God commit idolatry? Right, and that was built off a fun notion that we criticize human beings because they mistake wood and stone for God, but we thank God because instead of destroying Israel, He took His wrath out on the sticks and stones of the temple. Right, so which is it? Are you supposed to take sticks and stones, right, standing in for things, or are you supposed to, right, or sticks and stones, right, or are you not supposed to? Now, as part of that, I wanted to argue, and I believe that Stephen Schwarzschild says something like this, although I can't find it again, that when one talks about the prohibition of Avodah Zarah, which we'll treat as substituting images for God, so there are two ways in which you can conceptualize that. One way to conceptualize it is that the problem is that you're denigrating God by worshipping an image instead of Him. The problem with that is that it's not really truly you're denigrating God. Right, and Maimonides has desperate efforts to explain, what's so terrible if I know this is not God? I just need some kind of focus. I brought in Phil Cunningham from Boston College to talk to my students last summer about what he thinks about when he worships icons. And it was hard to imagine, like, what's the problem? Right, the NPR is running this series on Hinduism now, right, where the sophisticated Hindus are saying, and of course, it's some kind of connection to the Godhead. Nobody thinks that statue of Krishna that they're doing there is, right? So what's the issue? So I thought that the other way of conceptualizing it is to say that God can only have one image, and that's a human being. And so the problem with worshiping images is that it denigrates the role of human beings as the sole image, as opposed to the misrepresentation of God. Right? So Tselem, right? This is background as to what Tselem, right? So that we use a unique term, right, to describe human beings and the relationship to God, right, may not be coincidence, right? Because there really may not be any other, right? At the point, there may not be anything else that can do that. Whereas,
Tselem is related to the word tail.
Shadow, could be. Right? Samson Raphael Hirsch would have loved that because he believed in two-letter roots. Right? Contemporary Gamarians are not so happy with that, but heck, I went to the high school that's named after him. So I'm okay with it. Okay. So with that, with the word demut, right? So same likeness as the attempt, right? It means it can mean to be similar, but in medieval Hebrew, it tends to mean right a demion, is imagination. So I thought it'd be more fun to translate demut, which occurs in Genesis 5, as image, right? Because demut right actually relates to a verb of imagination, whereas tselem doesn't have anything to do with image. All right, find the novel. Okay. Okay. I got homework. Okay. So when the text here, right, so the text of the blessing, which says he's created the mold and image, the demut and tselem is melding 1 and 5. And then it talks about when he established for him from it an eternal construction, which is usually understood as meaning that the woman was built out of the man, and that's using Genesis 2. So we actually have in this blessing is an attempt at an integrated reading of all three creation stories. Right, the verb vayitzer and the image of Chava being created from Adam is Genesis 2, but the image of human beings being created in the mold and image are Genesis 1 and 5. And all that gets packed together into one blessing. That's just the fun of that blessing. But again, what's the point of number 2? Okay, so here, the rabbis tell us two stories. One story is that Levi came to Rebbe's house for the wedding of Rebbe is Rebbe Judah the Prince, the editor of the Mishnah. Right, so Levi came to Rebbe's house for the wedding of Rebbe's son, Rebbe Shimon, and made 5 blessings, right, not 6, which we understand as meaning he left out this blessing number 2, which we didn't quite figure out what it was doing there at all. Okay, whereas Rav Asi, who came to the house of Rav Ashi, much later, Rav Ashi is the editor of the Talmud, traditionally, although whether the Talmud we have is anything related to the Talmud he edited, if he edited the Talmud, is an issue beyond our concerns today.
It's a little bit like Roche's thesaurus, I guess.
So Rav Asi came to the house of Ravashi for the wedding of Mar, the son of Ravashi, and he made 6 blessings. Okay, so there seems to be some controversy about how many blessings you say, and we understand that as being a controversy about whether the second blessing, which seems so pointless to us, should be said. Okay, so the Talmud asks, all right, what were they disagreeing about? Right, why would one person put in this blessing and one person take it out? So they say, let's say that the point of disagreement was as follows. One held that there was one yitzirah, one formation of human beings, and the other person held that there were two. Okay, what would that mean? Right, what does that mean to say that there's an argument? Right, meaning that there's an argument about how human beings were formed. And I was trying to figure this out. Right, how could one claim, right, reading the text, what would it mean to say that there was one formation of human beings? What would it mean to say that there were two? Sorry, I've been talking all along, so now it's everyone else's turn.
Well, yes, I guess the woman was formed second.
Okay.
So there was a second.
So two makes perfect sense. Yeah. Right? We have a story in Genesis 2, which says that first the male was created, and then the female was created from some part of him. What does it mean to say there's only one creation?
The alternative might be that the first new creation is Isha.
That's still on the two creation front, yes.
Yeah.
So what does it mean? Right, so what does it mean to say that there was only one formation of human beings? Okay, right, so we just start with the, let's just start with the, now we should be sensitive up front, immediately, that we know that there is a tension between one and two, right, all the way through the text. Right, so something significant is likely going on, and next week we'll get to a text which spells it out in detail, because this is actually just a sort of red herring this week. But it'll become, yes.
Well, philosophically, I suppose, one's concept of human being, that sense, there was one formation.
Okay, so you could make the claim, right?
It's
right.
The male-female thing is accidental, but yeah.
Okay, right, so you make a claim that the creation of Chava doesn't count as a formation. Right, and we could do that in two ways. We could do that in the... I guess it would be classically liberal feminist way, right? That you're setting it up, which is to say that there's no difference between men and women, and so it really just means that one person was created and then other people were created. It happens that turned out being gendered. We could put it in a good old-fashioned sexist way and claim that, well, Adam was formed, and we don't quite know how women came about, right? But it doesn't rise to the level of the independent formation. I don't know. It is in the context of a wedding in which presumably, right, we would think that the formation of women has some significance. right, so I would agree. I would go with the liberal feminist reading, right, over the sexist reading if I had a choice.
About the one or the two?
About what it means for there to be one, right, is that it means that human beings were created,
right.
And that there's also a story in which a woman was created later as an accident, because who really cares? Human beings were formed once, and then other human beings come about, right? Human beings are formed all the time.
One story she created for a woman,
right.
The other one is two separate formations, right?
No, in the creation stories...
So it's Genesis 2.
In Genesis 2, right, first Adam is created, and then Chava is made out of him. In Genesis 1 and 5, all it says is male and female, he created them. That's all we know. Although it also says he created him, male and female, he created them, and we don't know, right, that's the problem we keep pointing out. We also can note that in Genesis 2, even though we use the word Adam, it's always referred to as the human being, right, which we'll talk about, right, with the notion of whether the original human being was gendered.
I mean, is the one you're drawing out?
Yeah, right, that's right.
Right, as opposed to two separate
formations. Yeah, right, that could be... Right, you could. Marty, do you want to say something?
Well, it's not something related. I mean, that the process, since human beings are gendered.
Say it again.
Since human beings are supposed to actually created.
So the one formation is really the creation of both of them, and the one formation is after they're brought together. Right, it's when God brings Chava to Adam that human beings are actually formed, because now they exist in relation. Okay, that could be as well. See, what do you want to say?
I was just going to say, could the one versus...
Okay, so you could read it as it... Right, you can't say authoritative and not authoritative, right? Because the rabbinic notion... Right, you could say that it's a question of which one is real,
right.
And which one is fantasy. That's exactly where we go, right? And And it turns out that is the solution that the Talmud picks here. The Talmud says, in the end, everyone held that there was one formation. Okay, which means, apparently at least, you know, on the superficial level, that we privilege the narratives of Genesis 1 and 5 over Genesis 2, which is the reverse, and we'll get back to that, of what what the first Rashi cites. Right? Rashi said the first story was fantasy, and the second one was fact. But here we're going to have a similar claim about what God's thoughts are, but textually it's going to go in reverse. Right? Everyone held that there was one formation, despite the entire narrative of Genesis 2, but one held that we follow thought, and one held that we follow action.
One person or one
text? Two rabbis.
The rabbi who said five blessings followed one of these positions. The rabbi said six blessings follow the other position. All right, what does that mean? As in the contradiction posed by Rabbi Yehuda, because he wrote, and which verses precisely set this issue up is a matter of massive manuscript variability. And one of the verses he cites is male and female he created them. But that verse, but that translation works for two different verses. In Genesis 1, it says, Zachar nekevah bara otam. In Genesis 5, it says, Zachar nekevah bira'am, which are substantively indistinguishable. So we really don't know. And furthermore, neither of those texts seem to create a contradiction about number, since the second text is that, right, since those both refer to two, and so does the second text he cites. So the truth is, we don't know which text he really meant to cite. But somehow he's creating it, right? As we saw, it's not difficult on the basis of biblical evidence to create a contradiction as to whether human beings were created single or multiple. So what he says is, Scripture writes, God created the human being in his, I should have said mold instead of image, right? And Scripture writes, male and female he created them. How can this be? Initially it arose in his mind to create two. Right, the exact same language is recited in terms of creating the world with justice, but in the end, one was created. Right, so now we have a Talmudic claim that a solution to one of the to at least some of the ambivalences about number in the biblical text is that there was a divine plan to create the world one way. And then it didn't happen that way. So this is what I call rabbinic imagination or the divine imagination. Because if God, I understand one of the ways in which rabbinic midrash is clearly dealing with a philosophic problem in different language. The philosophic problem you have, is how does God create the world? God creates the world because God speaks. Now, if you are being philosophical, so what does it mean, God speaks? To whom does God speak? Right? God speaks means that God thought. Right? God said in his heart. Okay. And we say, that when God spoke, the world was, right? Baruch Shamar V'Yaolam, blessed is he who spoke and had the right. So that, because God's will and existence are the same. So understand how radically it is for a notion to think that God thought of creating a world, which didn't happen. Right, so what Midrash is doing is we're going to take speech as we're going to take speech literally. Right, when God speaks, that happens. But it's possible for God to think without articulating. And when God thinks without articulating, that doesn't happen. Right, there's a process, there's a process that precedes speech, which is how God functions. Right, so that's what the Midrash does philosophically here. Right, it makes the claim that, now what does it mean to think of something but not make it happen? It means that God imagines. Right? So I think it's a stunning philosophic move. Right? To say the notion of something arising in God's thought which didn't actually happen, then by the time it gets to speech, it's entirely different.
Well, this is a great example of Axio Dei, because I know that I always think of doing more than I always However, Rashi has an interpretation, as you expound it, justice and then justice and mercy, makes some kind of conceptual philosophic sense. Mm-hmm. But the idea that God thought of two and by the end made one, it's hard to imagine what we might learn it philosophically or, you know, in souls in some way or intellectually from the idea, from that idea.
Okay, so let's spell out a few things, and most of them are going to raise questions, and next week we'll take through, this is a tangential place,
yes,
and we'll get to the main place, but this is a great way for raising certain questions. One is, understand, the rabbis take this really seriously, the point they're claiming that there's a dispute about whether, right, that divine imagination is not a throwaway line, because at least one rabbi thinks that in practice we make a blessing on the basis of the imagined as opposed to the real world. Right? Right? And actually our ritual where we say all the blessings, right, is built on, according to this, is built on, right, some recognition of the value of the imagined as opposed to the real creation. Well, we don't assume, we could claim that, you know, if we're Kabbalists, that things went wrong. Right? There is this, you know, the breaking of the vessels, right? I prefer, and you could read that into this text, I would prefer to read on the analog to the way Rashi does, that it's a change of mind as opposed to an accident. But although I understand that there is Kabbalistic notion of divine accidents, the vessels vessels aren't strong enough to hold the light.
No, it's just because it's written in the passive, right? In the end, what is creative?
That's correct. So you could read it in that way. I'm not. I'd rather not, but I agree that it's textually possible. Yes?
I'm troubled by he meant, but we do have male and female. Mm-hmm. He created one. So what was the effect that he imagined that he didn't create?
Okay. So this is, right, so this goes back to the question we asked originally, what does it mean to create two and create one? We had a whole series of ideas. We'll see next week, of course, that one of the rabbinic conceptions is that human beings were created as an androgyne, right, which is an idea that also has, has a lot about this. There's a number of books about the idea, right, of the originally androgynous human beings. It might be creating one as opposed to two means creating human beings together, right, male and female as one being, and then splitting them, as opposed to creating two beings separately. It might have to do with time, with whether they're created simultaneously or created with a time delay. But it's striking that the only narrative we have that tells us in detail about the creation of human beings seems to be pretty clearly talking about two. And yet the narrative says, no, everybody agrees there was one. Right? And what we're doing now is making Genesis 2 a fantasy. Right? Right? The first text we cited made Genesis 1 a fantasy. This text makes Genesis 2 a fantasy. God thought about creating human beings in stages, for first male and then female, but in the end he created them simultaneously. Worse than that, if I were to try and come up with a consistent rabbinic interpretation, well, I would say, well, it's not uncommon in rabbinic thought, and in thought of many, many cultures, to have men stand for justice and women stand for mercy. So if I wish to create a beautiful analog to the notion of God creating the world with, you know, planning to create the world with justice, and then adding mercy to it and combining them, I would say, well, God intended to create a universe which was entirely male. He saw that a male universe would not survive, right? And so he changed his mind, right? And he created gender, right? Instead, it works in reverse, right? God intended to create two, right? And then it didn't, right? And then it, right? He saw that wouldn't survive, so, right? So he created one. We could combine them and say that God intended to create, right? To create men and then women, but he saw that men alone could not even survive long enough. All right, to get to the creation of women, so we have to rush the creation of women, right, to get there from the beginning, because otherwise, as we see, you know, the first two men who are left alone on the world, one of them kills the other, right? So it might very well be that was necessary. We'll read next week, right? We'll try and work that out in detail. The questions that I'm raising first is, right, your question, which is a great question. Right, we understand. The first already, you know, it really made great sense. You know, we can all relate to this notion of world of justice is beautiful but won't survive, so we need mercy. Why does this matter to us? Matter to us so much, again, but I think, you know, that it's not just a textual game, because it matters to us so much that we design our wedding ritual, right, around what should have happened as opposed to, right, what might have happened, whatever, what God considered happening as opposed to what did. That right, that we're willing, in a sense, it seems, to sacrifice. It seems to me that it's got to be in some way a way, a way of taking one of the narratives, however we read it, one of the narratives, and saying that one of the narratives of Genesis is not intended as a descriptive, right, as fact. Right? So we're willing to go so far as to privilege one of the narratives over the other in terms of fact. Right? Right? And why are we willing to do that? And ultimately, all of this has to be a reading of all three stories. Right? I think I can argue fairly convincingly that the first, right, the first conception is a, right, is a clear reading of Genesis 1 verses 2. Right? Here, as opposed to the divine names which work out neatly, right, it's always Elohim in story, right, in the first narrative. It's always Hashem Elohim in the second. It's always back to Elohim in the third. Here we have a problem because even Genesis 1 and 5 have ambiguity. And this may be why they're being, right, why, you know, again, I'm assuming the rabbis read really closely. And so maybe they can't come up with a solution which is as neat as the one they came up with in terms of divine names, because the divine names are clearly separated. But here, the text went out of its way to introduce ambiguity, even into the narratives in 1 and 5. Right? It's not that it says, oh, there they're created together, there they're created separately. Right? Even in 1 and 5, it says sometimes 1 and sometimes 2. Right? And I would suggest that the rabbinic reading will be complicated precisely to match, right, that issue, right, that issue of the text. So what I hope we'll do next week, and I hope that we'll see all of you back, is we'll, right, any answers that you have, right, about why ritual should be constructed by imagination, why this issue should be significant, and then we'll, right, we'll see that a second rabbinic text works this all through various conceptions which are not grounded in the same textual problem as to what does it mean, as to how we read Genesis 2, what does it mean that Chava was created out of Adam, and how was gender created originally, right? Were human beings androgynous, right? Were human beings sexual, right? If you have an androgynous being, is it attracted to itself? Right, what's the conception of that? Right? All those issues are discussed, and hopefully after we read the second text, we'll be able to put the two together and develop a conception. Out of that, the hope is that we'll begin to try and understand why it is that this philosophic conception has such meaning rabbinic. I think that, that this notion of God imagining, not just that it's tremendously fun, but it's a very important theological statement. That God is that the world we have is not the world that flows inevitably from the nature of God. It's the product of divine choice. I think that's I think that's something which is significant, and hopefully, if we work out something meaningful, will become useful in understanding other rabbinic texts which deal with God's deliberations. Among other things, right, there's a whole series of rabbinic which discuss ambivalence about the creation of human beings. We'll see that this is a rabbinic philosophic conception, of the divinity that provides a key to all sorts of theological issues. Thank you again very, very much for coming. I'm sorry I lectured so much this week. I won't do that usually. But I had to